भगवते वासुदेवाय
ओम नमो 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 भगवते वासुदेवाय.
We'll be reading this morning from text 18 and 19 of chapter 9, canto 3, Brahma's Prayers for Creative Energy. So in the evening yesterday there was discussion about living entities that are foolish, neglecting devotional service, and instead engaging in dikkarma, forbidden activities. Prabhupada calls it work without sense. And entangling themselves in the reactions of fruitive activities and having their consciousness covered, forgetful of Krishna. Matiri Krishna Pratakspatova, that verse was discussed. But he ends the verse saying, I therefore offer my obeisances unto him who acts as eternal time. Well, the sentence before. As long as their tendency for foolish work remains powerful, all their plans and the struggle for existence will be cut to pieces. Remember that yesterday? Mogash and Mogakarma and Mogagana, Jesus. They're as industrious and diligent as they are trying to become successful material happiness, everything will be cut to pieces, and then cut to pieces agency is time. Eternal time. I therefore offer my obeisances unto him who acts as eternal time. So that connects with this morning's verse. Again, time factor. Your Lordship, I offer my respectful obeisances unto you who are indefatigable time and the enjoyer of all sacrifices. Although I am situated in an abode which will continue to exist for a time duration of 2 parardas. What's that? I looked it up. It says 1 parardha is half of Brahma's life and 2 is his life. So that's how long you live for 2 parardhas. And how long is that? It's a unit of time. And in the purport, in the word for word, Brahma has expanded that. So the duration of Brahma's life, it's a big number. The duration of 4 yuga cycles, Satya, Treta, Dwarapa, and Kali, is 4,320,000. And that's the duration of Brahma's day. So then there's his night, so it's times 2. 4,320,000 times 2, that's 1 day, and night, times 30, it's a month. 12, a year, times 100. That's what 3 parardha is. And the calculation is according to solar years. What's a solar year? That's another unit of time. That's the time it takes for the sun to travel on its ecliptic plane through the from one makra sankranti to the next, or from one position in its a geocentric unit. How long it takes for the sun to move around the earth in its northern hemisphere, southern hemisphere motion. So, Vedic cosmology is geocentric. We discussed this one of the times I was here, the distinction between heliocentric and geocentric, and the Western model is heliocentric, starting with Copernicus, and everybody else after that. And therefore, those folks look at Vedic cosmology and laugh. How primitive. Yesterday, this thing on the web, some Chinese gentleman did measurements of space, not time, from this the dimension of the universe, and then going down, down, down. I guess it's just some like a Google Map kind of a program where you can zoom down. The smallest micro, or you know, right in the middle is a human being. Then you go into, you know, an ant and a cup, and you know, smaller and smaller, and you know, like the smallest entity that science knows about. And then so time is also like that from Vedic perspective. Einstein took a shot at it. Time is relative. And the cosmology of the Vedas is not primitive. It just says this is giving the duration, this is the time, what to Dvipararas is the duration of time of the universe. I don't know how the numbers match about size, what the Vedas say, what modern science says, nor do I know if, you know, their measurement of how many solar years is the duration of the universe according to modern science, and at what point it's going to implode. I attended a program at the University of Houston once, and with the Indian Graduate Student Association, IGSA. And the presentation was on mysteries of the sacred universe. And you know, the topic was how the Vedic wisdom looks at the universe. And of course, the Vedic wisdom not only gives numbers of time durations of cycles of planets and the size and the distances and so on, a very precise number, which, say it carefully, which Western science, by the help of technology, is getting closer and closer to the actual number. But the difference between, one major difference is that all those numerical details that are presented by Vedic wisdom are with a God is at the center. It's not an atheistic, it's a theistic picture of the universe. So, one of the students at the end raised his hand and said, modern science has it down to milliseconds before the Big Bang. What was the state of matter? but they can't go beyond that milliseconds of just before the Big Bang. Then I asked him, what happens at the other end? And he said, well, they have two theories. One theory is the universe expands and expands and expands and expands and expands, and at some point the gravitational force can't hold and just goes flying in all directions, random chaos. And the other is it then implodes. So I said the picture that your modern science has is everything starts from nothing and it ends up in nothing. So what does that tell you about what your existence is today? What's the implication? It's nothing. So, and that's your model, and here's the Vedic model. Everything starts from God, it rests in God, and it comes back to Him under His direction. The numbers are the same. And one is you start with nothing and you end in nothing, you are nothing. And the other is it starts with God, it ends in God, and we should be conscious of God in between. Tell me which one you like better. And not only you like it better, but look at the quality of life, where there's atheism and where there's theism. Just that practical consideration, right? From a practical point of view. You may want to say, well, what's important is not just what's practical, but you know, what is. Okay, and here's the Vedic wisdom that says what is. And then how are you going to know what is? In the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, nobody can know what existed before you existed. That's like pretty simple. Doesn't require a lot of words to say it. Before you existed, what existed? There's no way to know. You can, by anuman, by logic and reason, you can guess. It seems to me that perhaps, maybe, in my opinion, but you don't know. And therefore Prabhupada would say, be honest. Don't call it science, because science means, comes from the Latin word skire, which means to know. The answer, the fact is you don't know. So just say you don't know. Instead of saying calling it science. That's not what science is. Science is you know. And what it means? Pramana, what are the means of knowing? Your senses are imperfect, your reasoning capacity is imperfect. So you don't know. How can you know? By descending knowledge. Shut the pramana. You can know. And you can know, not like, well, I believe that you can know. Anyway, back to Lord Brahma with his true pararthas. It's a measure of time that describes the duration of his life, which is the duration of the universe. And it can be calculated by geocentric numbers. How many solar years? Although I am situated in an abode which will continue to exist for a time duration of two parardhas, although I am the leader of all other planets within the universe, and although I have undergone many, many years of penance for self-realization, still I offer my respects unto you. I mean, I'm this big guy, but I'm subordinate to you. And then the obvious implication in the purport, what to speak of ourselves. what big idol are we? Brahma is the greatest personality in the universe because it's the longest duration of life. He is the most respectable personality because of his penance, influence, prestige, etc. And still, he has to offer his respectful obeisances unto the Lord. Therefore, it is incumbent upon all others who are far, far below the standard of Brahma to do as he did and offer respects as a matter of duty. So, Brahma has a long duration of life, but he's respecting that the personality of Godhead is indefatigable time. Or in the previous verse it says he acts through the agency of time, who acts as eternal time. So there's a statement in Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says, Kalosmi, time I am. More precisely, it's Kala Shakti. So Krishna and his energies are inseparable. So it's not wrong for Krishna saying time I am, but it's also correct to say time is one of Krishna's energies. And time, like all of Krishna's energies, acts under Krishna's direction. Because it acts under Krishna's direction, it acts this way, in this place, another way in the heavenly realm, another way in the Brahmaloka, another way in the lower planetary systems, and its eternal time is conspicuous by its absence in the spiritual realm. It's a nice phrase. Like Prabhupada has been saying, being unmindful of the Lord. Not heard that word used that way before. The opposite of being mindful is being unmindful. So, he's under the control of time as well. And Lord Vishnu is not under the control of time, he's the controller of time. And in the spiritual realm, time eternal, when he enters into this realm, he's not controlled by time, he's still the controller of time. He doesn't expire, doesn't take birth and die. Although he may perform lila, as the previous verse was describing, as if he's one of us, he lifts go or downhill, but he doesn't need to lift go or downhill with his arm. He can just will it in millions of go or downhills on the air, and there they go. By his potencies, without doing anything. This next verse he's going to speak about incarnations, or forms of the Lord that appear in this world. So, he's the root of the tree of material existence. He's the root of that tree which this material world is a reflection of, the spiritual tree. He's the root of that. He's not influenced by time, although all of us are influenced by time. And now, when he appears in this world, please bear in mind that it's not an ordinary, it doesn't become one of us by coming into this world. He's in that same position. Oh my Lord, by your own will you appear in various species of living entities, among animals lower than human beings, as well as among the demigods, to perform your transcendental pastimes. You are not affected by material contamination. You come just to fulfill the obligations of your own principles of religion, like Yadani Dani Kava Shabhadra Bhavati Bharata. Therefore, O Supreme Personality, I offer my obeisances unto you for manifesting such different pastimes, different forms. Purport. The Lord's incarnations in different species of life are all transcendental. He appears as a human being in his incarnations as Krishna, Rama, etc. But he is not a human being. That's already been stated. Anyone who mistakes him for an ordinary human being is certainly not very intelligent. That was soft. As confirmed in Bhagavad Gita 9.11, there's heart, it's muta, full rascal. Avajananti ma muta manushin tanamashritam. The same principle is applicable when he appears as a hog or fish incarnation. They are transcendental forms of the Lord and are manifested under certain necessities of his own pleasure and pastimes. Such manifestations of the transcendental forms of the Lord are accepted by him mostly to enliven his devotees. All his incarnations are manifested whenever there's a need to deliver his devotees and maintain his own principles. There's a verse in the second canto where it's stated that the Lord appears in all species. And I'm going to read a little section where Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur is explaining this. And the language of Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur is up here. And we're down here, so we have to like reach a little bit to capture his language. But the message is wonderful. Because I was thinking when reading that second canto, there are various species. There's insects, there's plants, trees. We know there's Matsya avatar, as Bhakti Siddhanta calls it, crustaceans. There's Korma avatar. Half man, half lion. So here's the situation that's being presented in Raya Vishnu. There's a scholar from Ohio State University during the time of Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur. His field was Eastern religion. So he went to Bombay to study Hinduism. And while he was in Bombay, he heard of the reputation of Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur. So he went to Calcutta and then took a train to Krishnanagar and went to meet him. He's a scholar, but it tells you something about the reputation of Bhaktisiddhanta during his own time, not just after, or because, you know, were his followers, but he was an authority, like a very well-respected special authority that, and apparently it's recorded because it gives like a word-by-word translation of a transcription of the dialogue between the two. So he had a number of questions. He had questions about deity worship, because Western perspective, deity worship is a problem. He had a question about transmigration of the soul. He had a question about many different things. And at one point, he's kind of, it's like halfway through the discussion where he's Professor Suthers, this is just to illustrate that Professor Suthers is overwhelmed by the intellectual acumen of Bhaktisiddhanta. You know, Bhaktisiddhanta is a sadhu, And this man's a PhD. So a PhD might very well think the sadhu is, you know, he's a nice man, but he's not a PhD. So he's asking him his questions. The Gita has admitted the doctrine of transmigration of the soul. What does your Vaishnava philosophy say about this? Bhakti Siddhanta. The Gita is not separate from Vaishnava philosophy. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, it has been fully revealed the true import of the doctrine, namely, that the changes of that of changes of birth for the soul. Christianity has disregarded this principle of change of births on the alleged ground that if it is accepted, men will restrain, will not restrain their sinful propensities. Rather, they will indulge in vices as their sweet will, at their sweet will in their present life, on the expectation that they will be able to make good their sins, guilts, and wrongdoing of this life in the course of the following months. But the Srimad Bhagavatam has crowned the principle with its true significance by means of a much fuller scientific and philosophical meaning by giving the instruction about the urgent necessity for ardently taking up and culturing devotion to God even while the human life, not easily available after in the afterlives, is at our disposal without spending a single moment thereof at other useless pursuits. His long sentences. It goes on. I just want to... he's quoting the Bible. He's quoting European philosophers. Though most of the Christians do not admit transmigration, yet many intellectual giants of the Christian world have shown several instances of their acceptance of the doctrine. Even in the Bible we find, quote, "And as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from his birth, and his disciples asked him, saying, Master, who has committed the sin, the man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Bible, St. John 9, 1 and 2. It is seen that even some Christian fathers clearly gave instructions about transmigration. Origen said, quote, I mean, like, he's not read, like doing what I'm doing, reading from a book. He's got a didactic memory. Quote, "It is not more in conformity with reason that every soul, for certain mysterious reasons, is introduced into a body and introduced according to the deserts of and former actions." And he gives the citation. Origen contra Celsia, Roman numeral 1:32. And again he says, "I am sure that I, such as you see me here, have lived 1,000 times, and I have come again. I have to come again 1,000 times. Said Goethe. He's quoting the Bible. He's quoting Goethe, which is a German philosopher. What the Greeks called metempsychosis, or what is transmigration in the English language, was at one time more or less admitted in ancient Greece, Egypt, and many places in the West. Some say the apostles of Christ the Great, failing to reconcile their previous and subsequent conclusions with the doctrine of transmigration, were compelled to discard it. Yet, no rationalist among the Christians has been able to refute the doctrine on the basis of sound reasoning. On the other hand, most of them have had to admit it. Herodotus, Pindar, Plato, etc. have accepted it. Huxley, the illustrious scientist of the 19th century, has written in his religious work, Evolution and Ethics, and again he's quoting from his didactic memory, quote, because he did this regularly. He was a walking encyclopedia. "None but very hasty thinkers will reject it on the ground of inherent absurdity, like the doctrine of evolution itself, namely, that of migration, that of transmigration, which has its roots in the world of reality, and it may claim such supports as the great argument of analogy is incapable of supplying. Professor Lutulowski has said, quote, I cannot give up my conviction of a previous existence on earth before my birth, and I have certainty to be born again after my death until I've assimilated all human experiences, having been many times male and female, wealthy and poor, free and enslaved, generally have experienced all conditions of human existence, unquote. But such transmigration theories of the empiricists of the West, or those of the Western philosophers of the 17th and 18th century, like Franciscus Mercurius, Helmont, Lichtenberg, Lessing, Heder, Schopenhauer, etc., or Jalaluddin Rumi of the Sufi sect of Persia, or the Theosophists, or of the Indian Nyaya philosophy under the aphorism, quote, from the desire for the mother's breast milk due to the habit of previous life, unquote, or of the Buddhist doctrine of annihilation in matter, these are assailable by various hostile reasons and have their origin in inductive concepts. They are incomplete and imperfect. But the conclusion in this respect of Srimad Bhagavatam is fully flawless and significant. The Vaishnava philosophy, having shown the royal road to the acquirement of the highest blessedness, even in the present life, there is no need of waiting for future lives. As such, the Vaishnava philosophy is thoroughly aloof from all wranglings, full of useless riddles over the doctrine of transmigration. That was his answer to the question, what does your Vaishnava teaching say about this? Professor Southers is stunned. He says, I am able to feel the super excellence of the Vaishnava philosophy among the Indian philosophies, but to my mind, the acceptance of idolatry in the Vaishnava philosophy, like other Indian philosophies, seems to be a stigma in it. And I'm not going to read what Bhaktisiddhanta says about deity worship, but it's up there. Then he asks about what the topic of this verse is. Amazed, Professor Southers says, I am truly astonished to hear from your holiness these mysteries of Vaishnava philosophy and their scientific analysis with most reasonable arguments. I could not even think before that there are Vaishnava philosophies with such excellent solution, collaboration, and elucidation of the problems of India philosophy. In the scriptures of India, adorable deities have been represented as creatures of the lower creation, like fish, tortoise, boar, etc. Is this approved by the sense of decency of civilized humanity? Some again are in favor of supporting such representations as allegorical symbols. Two and a half pages. Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur. Imagination does not find a place in Vaishnava philosophy. In it, or in the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the highest scripture for all men in the universe, has been described the topmost ontology about God millions of times better than what the most civilized races of humanity, 5,000 years old, nay, as old as 7 million of eras, can conceive of even in imagination. The eternal transcendental forms of the Lord that descend or are manifested according to the gradual evolution of the aptitude for offering service by the totally purified soul, quite aloof from the regions of the body and mind, where man becomes the worshipper of the ultimate reality at the loftiest stage of civilization, are never idols of imagination or allegories like unreal things manufactured in the mental factory of man, or like imaginary animal deities of the barbarians, such as tiger god, serpent god, horse god, etc. That was one sentence. The worship of Vishnu incarnations like fish, turtle, etc. is not fabrication of imagination like that of one of the five deities of the hedonists, formed out of imagination based on the coinage of set speeches like the imaginary concept of forms of Brahman, Panchopashana of the monistic school. The henotheists do not admit the transcendental personality of Godhead. The sects of figurative allegorists like the theosophists are not real theists, cherishing as they do doubt against the personality of God, and as such not having faith in realistic truth, and for that reason they want to curtail God's omnipotentiality and his transcendental names, appearances, attributes, sports by means of allegorical descriptions. The Vaishnava philosophy, or that of the ever-existent religion of India, has never supported the atheistic doctrines of such professors of imagination, imaginary forms of Brahman, or figurative allegorists. It is about the doctrine of pure and real avatar bhava, the cult of incarnation, that the philosophy of ever-existing India religion has said. As the pure and real doctrine of avatar, of fish, turtle, etc. of the Vaishnavas is not a kind of imagination of the barbarian taste, nor the idolatry of the Mayavadins on the basis of their aphorisms of form of Brahman, imagined for the convenience of practicants, nor the allegorical descriptions of the psychists. So it is not the anthropomorphism or representation of the deities having human forms as devised by the so-called civilized section of the people, nor I've never seen this word before. Therianthropism. Therianthropism, i.e. representation of one's tutelary deity in a combined man and beast form, nor the apotheosis, namely elevating man to the dignity of deities. These are respective types of idolatry of the mental speculationists of the inductive school. There's a short sentence. In imitation of Mayavada, the evil fruit of Indian civilization, anthropomorphism was invented in Greece and Rome, and the, here it is again, therianthropism of Egypt, etc. When the new doctrines get access in those countries, along with the commodities produced by the Indian civilization, which were based on the imagination of the anthropophysites, like the Indian Mayavadins, who exalted man or beasts to the status of God with the attribution of divinity to them, calling jivas and the poor as Narayana. With gratification of the senses in the background, then the mental speculationists of those respective countries adopted the cheap, vitiated Indian dogmas and, labeling new names on them, passed these doctrinal commodities into the form of religious tenets. But the true Vaishnava philosophy in India never indulged in any such doctrine based on imagination. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has refuted all such imaginative doctrines or ideologies and rejected both anthropomorphism and theanthropism. Therianthropism. He vouchsafed the Shastric teaching, namely, that he must be a heretic and a sinner who looks upon God and Narayan as equal to the deities of Brahma, etc. He's not done yet. Anthropomorphism, namely, representation of the deity with human forms and attributes, resembles the tenets of the bowels of Bengal, attributing divinity to the head of their sect, professing as they do, though wrongly, to have preceptorially descended from Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Such tenets are the mental imaginations of atheists, like the Baudas, the followers of Buddha, and of the bowels as above, running contrary to the teachings of Sri Buddha, Vishnu, and Sri Chaitanya, Vishnu, respectively. The Maivad sect, too, has adopted similar principles. Anyway, there's another section we directly explains it. Here we go. We have noticed the different stages of animal life, from the invertebrates to the fully grown human beings. These stages have been classified by the Indian sages of a scientific outlook in 10 orders, namely, 1, the invertebrate, 2, testaceous or shelly, 3, vertebrate, 4, erect vertebrate, as in the combined form of man and beast, 5, mannequin or dwarf, 6, barbaric, 7, civilized, 8, wise, 9, ultra wise, and 10, destructive. That's the Das Avatar, by the way. These are the historical stages of jivas, according to the gradation of these stages of as indication of evolution. Of the serving mood of the jiva soul, there are manifested 10 incarnations of God, namely Matsya, Kurma, Varaha, Nrisimha, Varaha, Parashuram, Ramakrishna, Buddha, and Kalki, as worshipable deities with eternal transcendental names, forms, attributes, and sports. Those who have acquired true knowledge about incarnations, with a thorough culture thereof, will be able, with the grace of the philosophers, trained in the school of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, to appreciate the ontology of Sri Krishna, specifically the intense sweetness of his sports in Braja. Professor Suthers. I have just listened to many subtle truths in the science and philosophy of religion. Please let me have a conception of these intricate matters. This is the end of the chapter. Bhaktisiddhanta says, the essential principle of Vaishnavism is that howsoever great a scholar and intellectual giant a man may be, he will not be able to appreciate even the easiest points of the Vaishnava philosophy until and unless he has entirely surrendered himself to an acharya whose character is the embodiment of the Vaishnava philosophy. You must have heard about the Indian scripture named Gita, which has been translated into different languages of the civilized world. There is a shloka in it, 434, which says that the Vaishnava philosophy is understandable only with an unconditional surrender, honest enquiry, and serving temper. It is only to such an approach that professors of Vaishnava philosophy, with these three as the preceptorial fee, that they give instructions about the concept of the correct philosophical truths. These professors are never to be tempted by any kind of worldly fees. In brackets, the professor was unprepared to fully surrender. That's a little glimpse of what association of Bhaktivinoda Thakura, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakura is like. Back to earth. Lord Brahma is appreciating that the appearance of the Lord Himself is transcendentally situated through His. He's the root of the tree of the material manifestation, so He manifests it. Brahma is an agent of that manifestation. The time energy where the material creation is operating doesn't affect him. The modes of nature don't affect him. The conditioning influences of fruits of intention doesn't affect him. When he descends, he remains in his transcendental position. He may appear in different forms. Those different forms are appropriate for the lila that he wishes to display. He is like the actor on a stage that performs the part of someone, but is not that someone. He may be a king or maybe a poor man or something, but he's not the king or the poor man. He's the Lord. You are not affected by material contamination. You come just to fulfill the obligations of your own principles of religion, and therefore, O Supreme Personality of Godhead, I offer my obeisances unto you for manifesting such different forms. Like Brahma, Prabhupada's description of why the form of a hog, because the earth had fallen because of Hiranyaksha's mischief. It had fallen out of its orbit and into the nether regions, and because of that unclean condition, he assumed the form of a hog to go to that place and with his tusks pick up earth. There's a pastime. And with Kurma, the demigods were in trouble. Demons had taken over their entire region, their kingdom. And so they went to Lord Vishnu. Vishnu informed them, this isn't a good time. They're stronger. If you engage in battle, you will be defeated. So better to make truce with them, like a tension diversionary tactic. Why don't you make an agreement with them that you'll churn the milk ocean and produce nectar, and they'll think that they'll receive the nectar, and so they'll participate. So like work together. Okay, so they work together. But the Mundra mountain was sinking for the churning purposes, so they needed a pivot place for the Mundra mountain. So he assumed the Kurma incarnation. In the commentary it says he had an itch on his back. And how does a turtle get scratch that itch on his back? His arms don't reach, so he leans his churnings again. He gets back scratched. Who can understand the pastime of the Lord? Each form appropriate for the circumstance, each form of the Lord to reciprocate with the specific or fulfill the desires of the specific desires of his devotees to see him in a particular form. It's all perfect and complete. Beyond our capacity to even imagine how to make something perfect and complete. And Brahma is appreciating that. Connected to it also is this idea of taking this place, this creation that Brahma has to make, that has so much suffering, unnecessary suffering involved in it, how to give reprieve or relief. So forms of the Lord that appear in this world are another one of the reprieves or reliefs, like he's previously described, remembering of the Lord and chanting of the Lord's name and the appearances of the Lord. Now, one of the thoughts that I've been having from reading this is how unfortunate it is for people that don't have this information. And what a great fortune for those who have it, and what a great opportunity in service to extend it to others. Expecting fully that persons won't say, "Wow, thank you." They'll say something else, like, "Get out of here," or something. People are crazy. Or something unpleasant. Still, the compassionate devotee wants to. If the value of the thing is so clear, it's compelling. You have to do something. Try at least. And people are abusive back, and that's part of the price. Extend it. Vidya vadhu jivanam. If the life of transcendental knowledge is sankirtan, taking this wonderful message and making a presentation for others to take benefit of, it's the life of transcendental knowledge. What's transcendental knowledge without life? Dead. Dry. Life of transcendental knowledge. Lord Chaitanya's sankirtan. Comments or questions? Yes?
Maharaj, thank you for a very wonderful class, Maharaj. A couple of points were very clear, like you have been addressing that in past classes too, that Brahma was praying today, like in the verse today, that even when I was praying, he did not lose his identity. Like he was like saying, like, I do all these things, but yes, I offer my prayers to you and I am subordinate to you. So that was very clear to me, like the sense of not losing one's identity, but at the same time understanding the greatness of the Supreme Lord and how insignificant I am in relationship to Him. The second thing was about the pantheism that we discussed yesterday morning, and in pantheism people have the conception that nature is, everything that's manifested in the nature is a form of God and they just worship it as God. But today's verse was talking about the transcendental forms of the Lord. Even though the form appears to be like a lower animal species or something like that, but it's still not the same, but it's a more transcendental in nature. I have a question, Maharaj, like at the end of the lecture you were talking about I'm not sure how to phrase that.
Compassion.
Yeah. When extending sharing Krishna consciousness with others, we might get a totally different reaction from the other person. So still as a Vaishnava being compassionate tries to extend that, but when that negative reaction comes from the other person, how should one process it and still retain the focus?
When a doctor is trying to administer medicine and the patient is acting up, how does he take it? In the same way. He's very clear. There's a disease. Here's the medicine, and they're acting up. Now, what's my assignment here? My assignment isn't to, he doesn't take it personally. Oh, they're acting up. They're in a disease state, and I have a mission to perform. I have to administer this medicine. So you stay focused on what the mission is. You know, supposing it's a small child. Supposing it's a cranky old person, whatever the different circumstances may be, appropriate for the circumstance, the doctor has to have his bedside manner. He has to be able to calm the patient so that he can administer the medicine. And ultimately, the patient says, no, he doesn't force it. There's, again, this is this parallel intelligence thing that I mentioned. There's the understanding of the circumstance, and then there's the understanding of the transcendental reality. And so, processing and staying fixed. But if you don't stay fixed in spiritual conception, ultimate aim and objective of life and acting in Krishna consciousness, then one gets caught in the swirl of the material energy, and everything is, you know, a series of endless adjustments that are never satisfying to anybody. And you become implicated in the karma and the modes of nature. Lost. Back to the first observation. It's the there are two things that Brahma is doing. Just, you said it, but I'm just rephrasing it. You said it differently. I'm rephrasing it. It's maintaining his own identity and at the same time humility, because humility, some persons that don't have the spiritual conception of what real humility is, they abandon their identity and take some other identity and try to be that. The spiritual conception is you maintain your identity and humility at the same time. The spiritual identity is we're eternal servant of God. So in that position of being the eternal servant of God, then there's gifts that God gives by which we can serve Him. And we maintain that identity as the eternal servant of God. Second part is staying in that humble position, not becoming puffed up by or proud with some little something that God has endowed us with to use in His service. It's meant for His service. That's it. And it's the happiness is having some service. Not the happiness is now I have some honor, distinction, or position or you know, success. Being the enjoyer of that. He's the enjoyer of it. It's for His service. That's the happiness, is His service. Whether it's, you know, more or less of whatever it is He's given. It's the position of service. So being happy to serve when there's in a situation where there's next to nothing. Being happy to serve in the position of servant when there's abundance. Not being the enjoyer of the abundance or the tolerator of the minimalistic situation. Just being happy to be in the position of servant. Happy to serve. Whatever the circumstances. In that way, one can have abundance and not be bewildered, and one can have restriction of resource, and one is happy in that position. Genuinely happy in either position from the spiritual perspective. Because the conditioned soul is hankering for resources, facility, for enjoyment. And the more resources, so theoretically at least, the more enjoyment. That's the whole principle of economic development in the West. More means happier. But it's not true. More doesn't mean happier. Conversely, less doesn't necessarily mean happier either. Happier is in the position of being servant. As long long as we hold on to a bodily conception of life, we'll never experience either real happiness in either position. Anything else?
Having a question after yesterday's class, Maharaj, like it's off the topic little. It's from Brihadbhagavatamrita, like Gopakumar, like he has this kind of desire to have, like to feel the relationship with Krishna. I'm not sure exactly, Maharaj, but something like that, and like he goes through different stages, and like he goes to Jagannath Puri, then he even goes to Swargloka, but then like he is not happy there. Like I mean, after some time he also feels not happy there. So my question is, Maharaj, like one is that is that desire like material, something material desire, like something for selfishness, something like that. And the other question is, like, what is the lesson I have to take, like, from that story, like, what Gopakumar goes from one stage to one stage, like. Not happy there, like, that matters, like, from my, yeah, I mean, what's the lesson I have to take from my practice, like.
First part is his desire to continue going to different places. Is that a material desire?
Yeah.
Well, if it wasn't Gopakumar, if it was us, it probably would be. But in Gopakumar's case, the desire is to see and to be with Madan Gopal, the worshipful deity of his mantra. He doesn't even know who Madan Gopal is. But there's like a primordial or intuitive sense of what that, of who was Madan Gopal and what seeing Madan Gopal is. And so, and that's a spiritual desire. But in our language, a little more proximate to our language, being situated in our eternal relationship with Krishna is a spiritual desire. And anything other than that, whatever that may be, it's insufficient. It doesn't make it. It may be whatever it may be, but it's insufficient. And the lesson, that's one of the lessons, that one can very easily, the different places that he goes to and goes to and goes to are distractions. There are opportunities to get diverted from. Life is filled with opportunities to get diverted from the real goal. So the lesson, one core lesson is, don't be diverted from the goal. Be clear what is the goal. It's just as much as you can be clear with something you have forgotten. And you'll, therefore it's more, to some degree, an intuitive sense, but now we have scripture, because Gopakumar didn't have that. We have scripture to compare to. We hold something up to the light of, that's what it is. And does this match that? On scriptural authority, but also something that intuitively we can understand from within. What's the goal? We're given a process of devotional service. Fortunately, like from get-go, we have a clear definition of what that is. Like Abhilashakashunyam Gyanakarma Janabhatam Anukayena Krishna Anushilam Bhakti Uttama. That's what it is. And then that's expanded in detail. But that is, there's the goal. We can strive for the goal, even we may not be there. We know what the goal is and stay fixed on the goal from whatever one's position may be. And then there's so many experiences of life, that's not the goal, and that's not the goal. Stay fixed on the goal. And by staying fixed on the goal, you'll achieve it. Or with Krishna's help, you'll achieve it. The biblical saying is, seek and you shall find. Like in a nutshell, that's the lesson. And life is filled with so many other things. It's like, maybe it's a big adventure. People get lost in the adventure and forget the goal. Don't forget the goal. And a subset of that is, the essence of it is when sincerity, even you may not be so clear what the goal is. In the beginning, Gopa Kumar didn't even know what his mantra was. He didn't know how to chant it. He didn't know if he should chant it like all the time. He didn't know if he should chant it some of the time. He didn't know if he chanted it certain times. He didn't know if he chanted it aloud or silently. He didn't know the meaning. But he knew he had been given something very valuable. And so he cherished that. His, you know, his capacity was minuscule. But his sincerity was superlative. And it's that sincerity that carried him to the goal. So that's our eligibility in devotional service, is sincerity combined with proper guidance. Because we can be sincerely foolish or sincerely misled. It's like, you know, what's the lesson to be learned from Srimad Bhagavatam? There's so many lessons.
Thank you.
You didn't have your hand up, but I could have something.
Yeah, I was a little hesitating. Again, it's not directly related. But this is Masi's question. We are reading Bhagavatam together.
Okay.
So we are in the Daksha's pastime. So while we were reading that, like Prabhupada's purport, like it's written, like how Lord Shiva is like, I mean, the assembly, everybody gets up, and I mean, Lord Shiva doesn't get up, so Daksha becomes angry and he talks, but Lord Shiva is not affected by all those, and there. Prabhupada's purport, he writes how he's a greatest Vaishnava, so he's not affected by all those anger or anything. But again, at the later stage, it said like how he gets angry when Sati,
yes,
she sets fire herself. Like. So like that, in so many other, I don't exactly remember where, but in so many other places also, like this kind of contradiction. I mean, it's not exactly contradiction, but it seems a little different. So she was asking me, like, why is it so? Like, one place it said, like, he's the greatest devotee. He's not affected by anything. So, so pure devotee state. You know? And the other place it's...
Okay, I got it.
So how should I answer her?
Well, that particular question is, there's a distinction between when... You can tell your daughter, when you become angry, and Lord Shiva is not affected like that. But there is such a thing as transcendental anger. And when there's transcendental anger, it's not being controlled by anger. It's a circumstance in a detached manner, a circumstance is most appropriately addressed by display of anger. So you use anger rather than anger uses you. And then you put it away. You're using in Krishna's service and it's not controlling you. And it's gone. Completely gone. Not like simmering, just not like roaring. It's gone. Gone. Appropriate for a circumstance that a transcendentalist, pure devotee, Bodhisattva or a pure devotee, may exhibit anger. Appropriate in service to Krishna for the circumstance. Because it's best for the circumstance. Or not at all. And then when the deploying of that is over, it's over. It's like having a sword in a sheath and pulling the sword out and showing the sword, putting the sword away. When Maharaj Pariksit saw personality Kali breaking the legs of the bull, he drew his sword. He was ready to finish him. Wasn't controlled by anger. It was his duty as a king. But when he questioned him, well, first he questioned the bull. Who has done this to you? Oh, it's very difficult to say. What's the cause of action? And when personality and Kali surrendered, just sort of like. And in a more general way, when it says this here and apparently the opposite there, there are several things that can be, you know, what is the perspective of material versus spiritual? That's one. Another is to emphasize a particular aspect or a particular point, Prabhupada may speak in a certain way, this tells us this and that tells us that, it's to illustrate. Like here's an example, you know, Arjuna's compassion is honored. In another place it's like, you know, he's attached on the bodily platform thinking, oh, if I win the kingdom then I won't be able to enjoy because the persons I would enjoy with, they're gone because they're not around anymore. So attachment and detachment. So it's to illustrate a particular feature or a particular point. You become bewildered when there's attachment. One can't discriminate between right and wrong when there's attachment. And later he gave up his selfishness in order to act for Krishna. Just on the anger point, Prabhupada specifically says on a number of occasions, Krishna was inducing Arjuna to anger because you can't fight without anger. But what kind of anger? It's not the anger of, you know, the person that's, oh, they took our kingdom, I'm going to get them. Not that kind of anger, because he already showed he's beyond that kind of anger. Another, what's the other kind of anger Krishna wants? Inducing them to transcendental position. And then at night they went to the tent of Duryodhana and without anger.
Krishna Maharaj, please accept my offenses unto you. Thanks for the class. This comment and later a little question. Yesterday you were talking about the forest and how to make a path up and down. That's really touching problem. That's what I'm going now, but it's really touching. If you work on up and down, but it become a path. But today's class, can you a little bit elaborate what Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur going to teach him, or I'm trying to understand what message he told to
the first like preponderance of dialogue, the first volume of dialogue was poking holes in the material conception. Here's the material conception. Look at this material conception. Let's take a look at it. Look at this hole. Look at that hole. And it's not just, this group. There's a whole bunch of groups of people that have really faulty, speculative conceptions of avatar. This theory, that theory, the other theory. There's an abundance of, and he just then deposited it in the waste bin. It's a little bit like what Brahma is doing. He just did it in a different way, that the Lord is transcendental. So as he appears, he may appear corresponding with various stages of the living entity, 10 in number, the jiva. The Lord is not a jiva, that's the first point. And to think of the elevated jiva or the fallen Lord, they're misconceptions. Or just some hodgepodge thing, some mixed up thing. So the Lord is the Lord and the jiva is the jiva, but the according to the jiva's liking, taste, capacity, he may appreciate like this, he may appreciate like this, he may appreciate like this. But it's still the Lord appearing in a form which a jiva of a particular stage can most readily relate to. And with spiritual potency, he's performing his divine lila to elevate that soul. Because the professor was asking, he wasn't just asking a straight question, it was a loaded question. The straight question would be, how do Vaishnavas consider this? His was loaded, saying, this is bad. So I'm surprised that your Vaishnava philosophy is so high and eloquent and erudite, but you accept this, misconception, lowly conception, erroneous conception. So the first thing he did was he poked holes in that notion, those that think that way, and elevated it to the transcendental position, and then spoke how to properly understand these forms of the Lord in other than the human forms. So demigod, human, animal, aquatic, from the various species, lower and lower. He's not those things anyways. He's the transcendental Lord. That's our Vaishnava conception. According to capacity and inclination, he makes his appearance. Time, place, and circumstance, he's expert. And he's speaking to a scholar. Well-read scholar that doesn't have any first-hand experience. He has just cerebral experience from things that he's read. So it's helping him go beyond that. And then, the last part was his saying, basically I have to think about it. And Bhaktisiddhanta's statement was, you won't understand just by thinking about it. Here's how you'll be able to understand. There's a system for understanding. He wasn't ready for that system to understand it.
Maharaj, I have one more quick clarification.
He has one before
okay,
you.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Good Maharaj, like anger management.
Anger management.
Yeah. You gave me one instruction last time about the Durvas Muni and Amrish Maharaj last time. Like Amrish Maharaj was not even praying for protection. His thoughts just went to the Lord. And the situation was always in a totally different manner. So, in my previous work at one place, like I had some kind of situation like that, and so I was just praying, but then it aggravated the other person like so much. Then, like, I was afraid.
The fact that you didn't get angry when he was in an attack mode.
Yes.
Agitated him even more.
Yes.
That's his problem. Same thing happened to Prahlad. Ranikashipu tried to destroy him. In so many ways, he couldn't destroy him. He tried this, he tried that, he tried the other thing, he couldn't. And that made him more agitated. I'm all powerful. I just raise my eyebrows and the demigods tremble. And you're my son and you're just a little boy just sitting here and you're not afraid of me at all. So now, what's Prahlad supposed to do? Oh, if you want me to get look like I'm afraid, I guess I can look like I'm afraid so you, like, to serve you, my dear father. But he was afraid. He wasn't afraid. But why was he not afraid? He was constantly remembering. That's his perfection. Vishnu Smaranam. Constantly remembering. So, if you're practicing what you described and you're not being afraid and not becoming angry and the person goes ballistic, there's like, you know, the trigger gets amplified and now what are you going to do? So you have some choices to make. You can get afraid or you can stay properly situated.
And what I did is, like, I told him, if you continue like this, I'll walk away from your office. And I did, and he came along with me. Right? And then it was a big commotion in office. And then he had to apologize.
For the devotee, that's you, the outcome is not the essence. The essence is the essence. It may play out this way, it may play out that way, and that's not the essence. In this case, it played out in a way that perhaps he learned a lesson. At least he learned, I can't just go yell at this person and get away with it. He may try the back door or the window or the basement or something, but you know, to get at you, but you can't use that one again. You'll have to make another apology and, you know, get some demerits or whatever. You can't use that one. May not change the person's character, but at least, you know, will come through. throttling you at your neck next time. Just try another approach. But, you know, that's his choice. For a devotee of that's taking shelter of Krishna, it's not that, you know, not a scratch will come from being in the material world. That's not the material world. That's not a real picture of what the Lord's protection means. The protection is my spiritual position. Your shelter that no one can touch, no one can harm except ourselves. We can trash it or abandon it or abuse it or forget it or neglect it, or that's in our hand. No one else can touch that.
Like, this is again Malsi's question. We were reading about invertebrates.
Reading about?
Invertebrates.
Invertebrates, okay. Mm-hmm.
And that earthworms, we were reading about the earthworms, like how when they are cut, when they are cut into pieces, like each one generates into new ones. So she was asking me, like, soul, what happens to the soul? Like,
Well, nothing happens to the soul. Are you speaking of entities that they're bifurcated and then you have two living entities?
Yeah.
So some soul can enter. If there's a place of habitation where life can be sustained, then possibly a soul can enter. Like fermentation is an example. There's not impregnation in the other sense of an egg, and you know, the egg becomes fertilized, but that there's a place where life can be sustained, the living entity can enter. Soul. So one soul, a facility, a soul can enter.
Jay.